The following interview was conducted with Wilma Jean Kay for the Purdue University Oral History Program. It took place on November the 18th, 2007, at her residence in West Lafayette. The interviewer is Catherine Marquis, the oral history librarian. Welcome. Okay. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about where you were born and your parents and siblings in the early years.
I was born on a farm in Huntington County, and I had a brother and a sister, and we were all very close together in ages. And my mother had been a school teacher in a one-room school for 2 years before she was married, and my dad always laughed and said he wanted to marry her before she got to be a crotchety old school teacher. My father came to Purdue for 2 years in the School of Agriculture. He had grown up on a farm, and that was all he'd known, and he thought, well, that's probably what he should do. So he came here, and at the end of his sophomore year, he was in the Army, ROTC, and their whole class, his sophomore year, and others, were called out for a disturbance on the Mexican border. And so they all departed in the summer, and they went down to the Mexican border to try and quell this disturbance. I think it was Vila was one of the big leaders. I don't recall now exactly what all the disturbance was about. And I don't remember exactly how many months they were there, but it was quite an experience for him. Because the place, the encampment, was all cactus, and they had to clean up all the cactus. As a result, he would never let us girls have a little cactus plant in the house because he said he'd seen enough cactus. Well, anyway, that was the early life, and so after it came out, I came back from that experience, he decided that they would get married, which they did, and they went on this farm in Huntington County, and that's where we were born. And he had several crop failures, and he just knew that farming was not what he wanted to do. So because he had 2 years at Purdue at that time, that qualified him to do some teaching. So he did teach some in the township school and over in Markle, a little town. And he did that for a while. And the summers he worked in construction and on the railroad, and he did several things over a period of several years because he knew what he really wanted to do was to go into medicine. And so ultimately, with even some summer school here and there, picking up some courses, and talking to the head of IU Medical School, he determined that this is what he was going to do. So here we were, three kids, and he was trying to raise three kids, and my mother had some health problems, so it was a pretty rocky time. But he did make it through medical school, and we lived in Indianapolis for about 4 years while he was going in residency and other parts of the program. And so he was, after he was graduated, my grandfather had some office space here in Huntington. So they, after looking around several places, they decided yes, and people warning them, it wasn't a good idea to go back to your hometown, but this is what he wanted to do. And he was a very successful doctor here for about almost 50 years. Mm-hmm. And I attended his graduation when I was 12 years old. So I realized the importance of it. Sure. So anyway, that's pretty much what happened there. And
then what was high school like? You went to high school in Huntington then?
Yeah, went to high school in Huntington, uh-huh. Right, in the local high school.
And then what?
Purdue.
Purdue.
Then I went to Purdue, came to Purdue in 1935. And I was absolutely delighted because my father always spoke very fondly of Purdue. He loved Purdue. And even though he's going to IU, his loyalties were still Purdue all the way. So we all grew up with the idea that Purdue was the place. And so my dad brought me to school. My mother really didn't have the heart to come with me because she was so brokenhearted to lose the first one from home. But so anyway, I came, and the only women's residence hall was Doomy. And so this was a whole new world and a whole new thing for me. And then very shortly, I understood that Amelia Earhart was coming. And being 17 years old and very shy, I thought, what could I ever say to Amelia Earhart, you know? So I was very reluctant to, and we were all welcome to go and sit at the director's table at the evening meal particularly, or lunch or whenever. And somehow I could never quite get up my courage to really go and engage in conversation. But I had the privilege of observing her a lot, and she lived in a suite down on the first floor, and I was on the third floor, so that way I didn't see that much of her during the day. But occasionally her husband would come and visit, but not too often. But anyway, I did hear her speak on a couple occasions, and I was very impressed with her. And I was very impressed because she was a different kind of a woman than I was used to seeing. I mean, she was tall and short cropped hair and a slim figure, almost boyish figure. But she was always seemed very cheerful and pleasant. And I always regretted that I just didn't have the courage to, but it was just that I was just too young and too shy, and I was rather in awe of her because here she was flying airplanes, and my goodness, it hadn't been long since every time I'd hear an airplane fly over, I'd run out in the yard and look up and make sure that, you know, see this wonderful thing. So she impressed me a great deal. Also, during that period, Lillian Gilbert came and stayed in the hall, not as long or not as much, but she was here as a consultant on time and motion study, mostly in the School of Engineering. Right. So she was a much older woman than Amelia. I don't know how much, but she was the one cheaper by the dozen. They had a big family. And a very interesting woman, but she was older. There again, I didn't get that much acquainted because she was not around that much, but she was definitely living there or in and out a lot. So that was kind of my experience. Unfortunately, I should have, if I'd known then what I know now and been the person that I've grown in the years, I would not have hesitated to, although I would have still been a little bit shy about it, but I would have talked to her. But things change a lot from your 17 till you get to be my age and how you accept and what you do.
But what was your major at?
Actually, this is kind of strange too in a way. When I was in high school, there were three home economics teachers graduated from Purdue, and one was in clothing and textiles, and one was in, kind of a mixture. She taught some foods and some clothing. But the one I got the closest to was Emma Klein, who was a foods major at Purdue. And she took an interest in me because she could see I was very interested in foods work. So she brought me to Purdue and toured me along with another girl that was coming to, or two other girls that were coming to Purdue. So she had a very good friend, and you probably have heard of these two that were professors in institution management. One was Ruby Clark, and one was Edith Gamble. And so she brought me over to the school, and Ruby Clark was a very good friend of hers. And she introduced me to these two wonderful professors and ladies, I later found out. Well, I felt very comfortable with it. It was institution management, which is now the RHIT program, and it's grown now from where we were, a class of 25, to well over 400, I understand. So anyway, that cinched everything. After I met them, and I was already sold on Purdue, there was only one way to go, and institution management. Sure. I have never regretted it, because I thoroughly enjoyed Food's work.
What was the campus like? Were you in, did you join any clubs when you were here?
Well, I didn't know a thing about sororities, but after we left the residence hall, we had 1 year. We were allowed only 1 year in the hall because they were trying to save it for incoming girls. And I.
That, this residence hall was for women only?
Women only,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, well, everything on campus was women only or men only for many, many years till we had the courts, which was a long time later. And
excuse me, Dumie is not as big as it, it was smaller at that time. They haven't they built onto it? There's Windsor.
Well, that was part of the Windsor Comet
okay.
complex. And then they came along. There were Sheely and right. Wood, and the other. There's another hall there that came along fairly soon. But they, I think, Sheely may have been under construction, or Wood Hall maybe, because when my sister came to school 2 years later. Or 3 years, she could get into Wood Hall, and she lived in there all her schooling. But when the rule was, when I was there, that after your freshman year, it was necessary you move out. Well, I didn't want to move into a rooming house because I felt that was not good for me to be off campus, and so I didn't know one thing about sororities. So. There were six sororities on campus, and my mother had never belonged to anything like that when she was, of course, she went to a teacher's college for 2 years. And so anyway, the idea was that you came and you lived for, I don't know, is it like a weekend and 2 or 3 days in the Union, at Purdue Memorial Union. You moved in there, and then you went around to little teas in these six sororities. Well, I didn't know anything. It was okay. I enjoyed them. And it was a good way to get acquainted with a lot of girls.
And the food was good, too.
Oh, I never minded that about the tea. That I enjoyed. And so it turned out, and I didn't know this in the background, that there were two Alpha Chi's that lived in Huntington. They had graduated the year before. They had alerted this sorority here that I was coming and to notice me as I was coming through Rush. Well, I didn't know anything there, but they did quite a snow job on me. And I did like the girls, and they were very friendly and nice, and over the years I've been very active in the alumni group. And our daughter, I was so happy here when she came to Purdue. She, after Rush, she joined Alpha Chi, and then I had a granddaughter that joined here about 6 years ago, and she's, or no, seven. She's now graduated from Purdue. So that was a gratifying experience all the way. And but that was the alternative then, and I was glad that I,
sure.
That this was the alternative and worked out well. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of that, my experience there, and then I was active all those years, and which was great, very nice.
After graduate, now when did you graduate from Purdue, and then what was next?
1939.
Okay.
And I had the good fortune of being hired by Purdue Memorial Union as an assistant food supervisor, and I was delighted because this, I thought that would be nice to stay on campus just a little bit longer, because I felt good about everything, and I was felt like home, and I wasn't quite ready to go out in the world and be in Food's work some strange place. It would have been okay, I guess, but anyway, I was there for 2 years. And it was a good thing I stayed, because during that time, I guess I went over there in the summer of 1939. And it was hot as blazes, and they were the only thing that they could do any ventilation. They had the tall fans here and there, and they were doing some remodeling in the union. And so, and just a little side thing, during that time, I began having a rash on both legs. Oh, it was just itched like crazy. And so I went up to one weekend, or one time I saw my dad, who was a physician. I said, I don't know what's going on here, but this is just really getting to me. And he said, you know, and he looked at it and he said, you know what? He said, I think I just read about this in the medical journal, that they've come out with some new hosiery. And of course, we all wore long hosiery at that time. And I think it was the nylon in them, that some people were allergic to it, and the heat made it worse. Well, that was the answer. So quit wearing them, and he said, and they said the best thing to do was to get it back, to go to silk or their rayon. I did, and that cured it. But I thought that was kind of interesting. But anyway, this was, I didn't have a desk, and I don't know if you were familiar at all with Geneva Nugent.
I recognize her name, but that I've heard others speak of her.
She
was there for a long time.
I think about 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she knew foods like I've never known anyone. And it was her whole life. And she had grown up in Lafayette. And I learned and learned and learned many things. And I learned it, how not to treat people. And she was a bit of a tyrant, but that was part of her being she ran the food service and union about like a military. I mean, it was, and her food was excellent. And we even had, I'll bet many people connected with union have no idea over there that we had a butcher shop in the back of the kitchen, and we had a butcher who cut our own meat. She insisted on that. How long that lasted, I don't know, because I lost track a lot with military service and babies and so forth. But anyway, we did have that. And of course, we were, at that time, we were reaming our own orange juice in the morning, and I was working in the kitchen. Now, I wasn't sitting at a little desk. I didn't even have a desk. There was a desk in the middle of the kitchen that the supervisors could drop their pencil or a pad off and progress to the next place. But we worked in the kitchen side by side with cooks, salad makers, bakers, everybody. And so that was a good learning experience. But some days it just about killed me, because we were on our feet all day except when we ate. And that was quickly eating lunch and dinner or whatever. And it was not uncommon to work 12, 16 hours a day, and that was just it. Sometimes straight days for whoever, whatever. But I learned a lot, and just to tell you a little bit about, I was glad when garbage disposers came in, because Miss Nugent, I was telling someone this morning about this, and it occurred to me. The garbage cans were big like that, that tall. And I have seen her in the salad department go down in the garbage can up to her shoulders, feeling around to see how much they wasted in the way of lettuce and this, because food cost was a big item. And so that tells you a little bit about her. But and she would just sometimes bawl out the cooks in a loud voice in front of everybody as she was going through the kitchen. You could hear her. She would come in like a full sail ship. And But she had order, and our food was excellent. And high standards, very high standards. So I had a lot of respect for her, although sometimes I felt like I wanted to shed tears when I hear her pick on some of the people. And I caught it a couple of times, really. And so I had, because I was making roll dough one time, and I made a mistake as I read the recipe, and I was enlarging it, and I had too much flour in it. I don't know how she caught wind of it. She could see everything that was going on. So she came by and she said, "What is wrong with this dough?" And I said, "Well, Miss Nugent, I inadvertently put too much flour in it." Oh, she just screamed at me, and she said, "We could have taken care of it." Oh, I had just thrown it in the garbage can. "Oh, we could have taken care of that. We could have added something to this and added that and this and that." Well, so, but as I say, that was one sample. I caught it, and that's why I realized. So. But anyway.
Where were you living when you were working in the union? Would you live, were you still living in the sorority?
No. Oh. And the apartment house is still there on University Street across from the home ec school. There's a big white apartment house. I come down on University Street, and of course there's left-hand side is this big white apartment house. I think it's the first or second one in. It may be the second one in. And a lot of staff at Purdue had lived there. And we had an apartment in the front on the second floor. There were four of us crammed into this small apartment. It didn't have any food service, and we didn't really need it because the other three girls, two of them from Michigan State, and the other girl that graduated with me, they had jobs at the residence halls in food service. And so we lived together there for 2 years, and that was nice. Mm-hmm. So anyway, one of the good parts, the best part of this whole thing was we had been working on some big reception or something one Sunday afternoon, and one of the girls that was brand new with me, she came from Iowa State, and her dad was dean of students, and we became good friends. And so Jane had a friend from Iowa State. She was already pretty much engaged to somebody else, but this was another one that had come to Purdue for graduate school in civil engineering. And so one Sunday evening, I guess Robbie said, this is the fellow that was Jane's friend, said, "Oh, I'm tired of studying. Why don't we see if we can find some girl? Who do you know that we might," Bill said, "Bill, that my future." He was brand new from University of New Hampshire, and he was just getting started in civil engineering in grad school. And said, Do you know somebody, some girls? Let's go out and get a Coke or do something." And it was, by that time it was probably 10 o'clock because we were just cleaning up from this reception and banquet or whatever. And Robbie said, "Well," he said, "I know Jane Helser. Why don't we call her and see if she knows any girl?" And I wasn't for blind dates at all, and I was sort of semi-engaged to a fellow that had gone to Connecticut to work that just graduated from Purdue. So he said, "I'll just call Jane." And so Jane asked me if I want to go out, and I was tired. I don't think I wanted to go out any place, but I said, "Okay, I'll go out." And they decided they'd go to the sweet shop and have a Coke. So, and here was this strange guy from New Hampshire. Well, I knew it was all over that night. That was it. So we dated, and that was 2 years later. That was in November of 1939. And so, and So he was a good salvation sometimes, and I'd come walking home late from work, way late at night after receptions and everything. He was always, would walk me home a lot of the time, and sometimes there were tears because I was so tired. Oh, my feet would feel like boils. You know, you're on your feet all day, and you just don't realize how your feet can feel at the end of the day. But anyway, so that was the really good part. And so then...
Now then the war came on, so did he have to go into the service? The war was on by
this
time.
Oh, yes. And it was, things were just heating up very good all over the world. All over the world.
And then you were here till 41 working,
huh? Yeah, so... anyway, we were married in November 4th, 1941. We just celebrated our 66th wedding anniversary. And so, of course, Pearl Harbor was a month after we got married. And by this time, he had got his his graduate degree had a job in a construction company in Newport News, Virginia. So we went there and in an apartment which is right across from the big Navy, or the big base there in Virginia, right there where the...
Newport.
Uh-huh, right. And so we were right across from that, and all the activity was going on. You'd see big aircraft carriers in there and all kinds of things going on. And of course it was, soon we were into it. And Bill had been he was born in Canada. However, he didn't live there very long, but he had just gotten his U.S. citizenship in June. And I could see he was getting restless and wanting to get in, and they were needing officers badly. So he applied for a Navy duty, which is what he won. And my goodness, I think he hadn't any more and applied, and he had a call, and with a couple of days from Chicago, we want you. Well, this was kind of a shocker because here we'd been down on this construction job for several months, and in the meantime, I was expecting, of course, and that added to the whole problem. And our son was born in the following December. So finally, by I think it was August of that summer, he was in the Navy, and so the decision was what we were going to do, because people don't realize that you just didn't go and trail your guy around into as they were having training and they were doing all this. So my folks very graciously asked us to come home, and they said my mother was very busy at that time helping my dad some in the office, besides he had some other help, but he was so busy, he was having office hours at night, and he only made house calls, and my mother really was quite busy helping him. She said, "We're willing to have you come, and we're glad to have you come, but there's no way you can go out and work." By that time, my sister was home, and her husband, who was in the military, she was out teaching, and she finally wound up working in a factory in Huntington. She said, "But I can't take on raising a baby on top of it, so you can go work." I said, "That's perfectly all right. That's what I expect to do." So we were there most of three and a half years. And so he did have, he had worked in, civil engineering just for a few months before he went into the service. So thankfully he had the opportunity to come back to Purdue, and when the war was over then and we could find a place to live, and the only reason we found a place to live was R.B. Stewart asked him if he, knowing that he could survey, if he would lay out a horseshoe-shaped place out in what is now Tower Acres. And that they would like to put some little temporary homes, and they turned out to be national homes, out there. And Bill said, well, I'll be glad to do it, provided I can have one of the homes, because we don't have a place to live yet. And in the meantime, he'd come back, and he was a roomer with, well, like, well, the Knapps, Dean Knapp. They had taken him in graciously, and he was living there. And so we did get moved in November of 1946, and he had been released in January. So we were lucky at that, because a lot of them were veterans returning, moved into the Black and Whites that were over. And we had many, many friends that were living in what they call Black and Whites, temporary, very temporary, on State Street. And many of them were longtime staff members after that. And so we lived there then for about, I think, a little over 3 years, until we built our home out in Sugar Hill. I don't really know where Sugar Hill is or not, but we lived there for 52 years. And that again was because of Bill's surveying ability. And R.B. Stewart had this plot of land that had belonged to the McCormicks, which was a cornfield. And he said, he called Bill and he said that he had wind that these folks were going to sell to someone that was going to put some national homes in there. And he did not want that to happen next to the university. And he also wanted to protect his property because it was right next door to us beyond the woods. So he asked Bill, he said, would you come in? And he told him a little bit what he wanted. And I think it turned out about 16 homes we had. And that was right off of McCormick there, just beyond Stadium. And so Bill went in and laid this out back toward the pasture field and around. And so Bill again said, I'll be glad to do this, provided I can have choice of a lot. And so we did. We got back in the corner, and I had the fields behind us and the woods where I could go and walk and take the children, and we loved it. 52 years was great, but I hated to leave there, of course. And
now, your husband was with the civil engineer. Did he join the faculty? His specialty was surveying?
He taught a lot of subjects there. I think he finally wound up, materials testing, hydraulics. When they needed someone in the beginning, they would plug him in to do all this. And so he taught several things. Then he was chosen to be co-op coordinator for the School of Civil Engineering, and that was his great favorite. And he was that for about 20 years. And he loved to, they were outstanding students. And they would go and work away from Purdue with various industries. And he was very much involved in placing students with different industries and getting acquainted with the industries and getting very well acquainted with students. And he had some very outstanding students that he still hears from.
That's wonderful.
And
Now, did you work, you were with the university as well?
I did not go back to work until the children were in school, both of them. Our son was 5 years older, of course. Laurie was born in 1948 after Bill came back, of course. And so I did not want to go to work until they were both in school. And so Laurie was six, and we had a neighbor that worked in the residence hall. And so one evening, we were having a social evening, and I told, somehow offhandedly, I said, sometime I think I'd like to work in the residence hall. And he sat back up on his chair and he said, are you serious? I said, well, yes, but I don't want to work full time yet. So I did come in and work half time. and I decided I really, really liked it. And then they had a special procedure in planning menus with some charts. And so, in time, they assigned me to planning menus. And I did plan the menus for the halls with, using charts and meetings and so forth for over 15 years. And
how many residence halls were there? There weren't as many as now, were there?
No, and I was fortunate. This was another thing about, I was very fortunate at the time I worked. Because when I came in the residence halls, and that was in, I started in, I guess, 1954. I have to think back how old Laurie was. And
that's a good perspective. When you put your children in, you can slot it in a little easier.
Yeah. So anyway, there was the only hall then was the Windsor Complex, or part of it, and Meredith Hall. Meredith was all there was at that time, and Carrie Hall, of course, the men's hall.
Sure.
So I was fortunate that during that time, my working for 26 years, I saw 9 halls brand new come online. And then they had one of the latter ones, they were still needing housing for students because, see, it had gone from 6,500 students when I was in school to huge influx that kept coming and coming after World War II, and they kept needing housing and more housing and more housing. And so it started with Owen, we called them 1, H1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and Owen and Tarkington and Wiley, and then we got into Earhart and then Harrison, and, you know, till we had 9. Then the courts. And so here was an experiment that they had not tried yet in the residence halls. And here they were building these courts. And they were adjacent. Fowler Courts was where I was assigned finally. It was right next door to the Old Poultry Building. And so they turned that into some housing there too. So we had, that was quite an experience because it was decided that it would be for about 650 students. And they would put maybe about 50 in the upper floor of Fowler House. And there would be the first 3 courts would be women and the last 3 courts would be men. Never had Purdue housed any men or women near each other in the residence halls. Well, some of the natives, the locals, and some of the parents, and just a lot of people were very distressed and concerned putting men and women students that close together. And so it was great. We had a wonderful social program, and many were married, and it lasted. And I still hear from some of them that have children, and now some that are married and have grandchildren. So, but anyway, it was wonderful. And I had a waiter staff that was composed of both men and women. And I'd have between our night maintenance crew of students, and that I'd have between 90 and 100 that worked according to their schedules in the kitchen and various cooking or frying or counter or whatever. And it was a great experience. And so we were the first to do that. So
that's kind of neat.
It worked great.
Were those in days when it was still served, or was it cafeteria style?
It was cafeteria by that time. Mm-hmm. And we had to go into cafeteria because, first of all, we couldn't build the dining rooms large enough to hold the number of residents to feed that many. So we had to rotate through cafeteria is what we did. Mm-hmm. So we had 2 serving lines, as most of the new halls did to start with. And So that was when we really got into the cafeteria service, which worked fine. We had awfully long lines sometimes at Fowler with the numbers we were serving. And something that's kind of cute, when we first moved there, you know, students have, they have been thinking the funniest things. Because Fowler House had been the old poultry building, for a while they called it Cackleberry Inn. So that was kind of a fun
little
thing.
Name on there.
Yeah. It took us quite a while to outlive the Cackleberry Inn, but anyway, it finally disappeared. But so I saw a lot of changes in food service there. From the time I started, you know, we were having fish delivered in iced barrels on the dock, and we were getting beef that in pieces that the cooks had to portion. You know, now all this comes in, all portioned, breaded, whatever. Same beef and pork and anything we were serving. No frozen food yet. And now they get in all this frozen food, even and the potatoes that are all peeled and bagged. And we finally had a machine that would kind of, I don't know, it's almost like it had a sanding operation. You put a whole bunch of potatoes in there with water and they would be tossed around and come out. And well, the peeling was pretty well off, but they still had eyes. And so they'd be dumped in a great big deep sink. And I had a woman that would be taking eyes out of potatoes most of the day and then putting them in ice water and wheeling them in a big can into the cooler for overnight's use. And but now they get in all the powdered baked potatoes. They sure tasted different, though. The fresh, there's no difference between mashed potatoes. There's a great difference between mashed potatoes made with fresh potatoes than these powdered things. They are improving, but not there yet.
Right, yeah.
So it was a huge job of preparation. And so now all these, when we were baking all our pies and cookies and cakes from scratch, and even the pastry we did, and a wonderful woman baker that loyally drove from Attica and all kinds of weather there to come and bake. And the students loved her because the waiters had come in hungry to work at lunch, and she always happened to have broken cookies. And I just turned my back and let them eat broken cookies. And I imagine she broke a few. But so you have to be a little resilient in this type of work when you're working with students.
And
had a great group, a great time.
How has the campus changed? There's a lot more. When you were here as a student, there were not very many women on campus, were there?
Oh, no. Oh. No. And not very many at all. I don't know. Let me see. What was the ratio then? At one time I knew about what it was, but I think it was about 12 to 16 to 1. And so it was a long time before, you know, we got that ratio changed. But anyway, the campus, as far as the students are concerned, I see so much. I mean, I do see a lot of difference because the women in my class, they all wore skirts and dresses and, of course, that time, saddle shoes and bobby socks were popular, and that's what we wore. And the men wore nice-looking slacks or sweaters or that type of thing to class, and they all looked well-groomed. And another change I see, and it really bothers my husband, the staff, the men all wore coat and tie to class. And now he goes over to anywhere on campus and he sees them from jeans to looked like they just come off the working in a barn someplace, and this disturbs him a great deal because he feels that they should be setting an example for the students that are going out in the business world. And so that's just a whole other story. And then, so that's different. I see a big difference in the behavior of students. I never heard of a party. And now partying and drinking has become a big thing, and it's very disturbing to me. And we had such a good time. I was in the era of the big bands. I think I was on campus at the most beautiful time anyone could be, because we had any band that was anybody that came here from, you know, all the Dorseys and everybody that was any good, Paul Whiteman, you name it. We had the big extravaganzas of dances where we had sophomore cotillion, and they actually lined up with their swords like this at the doorway, and it was a formal affair. The beautiful formals, long dresses of all kinds, and corsages. And it was, so we had sophomore cotillion, we'd have the military ball, we had the junior prom, we had, and every Saturday night a mixer. And I don't know, I think most Saturday nights, or a lot of Saturday nights, we would either go to the mixer and dance, and the ballroom would be crowded, and movies were popular. So all we did was, for recreation, would be dancing or going to a movie.
Mm-hmm.
It was wonderful.
Yeah.
Never in all the time I was in Purdue was I ever invited to go out drinking. Never dated a guy that did. There was only one booze joint on West Lafayette, and that was the Chocolate Shop, I think was just starting. And if the men wanted to drink, there'd be a group of them get together, and they'd walk across the levee, and they'd go over town and drink. It was not respectable for women to accompany them, or even go to a bar. There were some, I think, did, with a guy. But it really wasn't respectable to go for a woman to go to a bar. And too bad it changed. And but anyway, I'd never heard of partying out in the apartment, rooming houses and this kind of thing. Never heard of anything like that. And of course, Triple X was the only fast food. I think the only fast food for anywhere around. I don't know. And they delivered at night if you were studying, and I don't know how late they ran anymore, but they would deliver to sororities, fraternities, or whoever if they wanted something later. I don't know how late they operated, but I know they did this. And so,
and the levee has changed, hasn't it?
Oh my, the levee was a burning dump. And I mean bad, bad, bad when I came, and was that way for years.
You put your trash there?
Well, trash was hauled in trucks,
mm-hmm.
and a big dump right there along the river. And that would be burning night and day, and not a very good smell down around there. It's about where, you know, they finally put in Sears. But that went on for years that we had that. Down on the levee, other than that, we had Ruger's Bakery, and I think there was another bakery that came in. And of course, on the hill there, where Chauncey, all that now is now, that was just a big weed patch for years and years and years. The only thing in it that was looked good was some wild hollyhocks. And of course, in the village itself, there was just the post office. There was a post office for everybody, and a couple of bookstores, Deke Reisner's, and of course, Southworth's, and then University Bookstore, I think, finally came in on the corner. And the bank was there, and a couple of drug stores. And we had a little grocery store in there for a while. So naturally that changed a lot, and we had two churches, the Methodist and the Federated, and the library, and that was just about it. Mm. And
certainly has changed.
Yeah. Mm. And one other big change was that no cars were permitted by students on campus, and you had to have a very special permit that either you have sick parents, people you were needed at home, or you lived on a farm and you were needed at harvest time or planting time. You had to have a guilt-edged reason why you needed a car, or a work situation around here, or off that you needed a car to get to. So we had very, very few cars. Mm-hmm. And street cars were the mode of getting around. And so even if we wanted to go to the basketball game, when I was in school, Lambert wasn't built yet or finished. And so we'd have to ride this streetcar to go over to Jeff High School to watch the game.
Did Purdue play there?
Yeah, that's what they did there at that time. And so this was kind of a fun time riding the group of students over to the game and back. And then one kind of funny thing that happened, just as regular as clockwork, on the week, be coming back on the streetcar, and I think they chose the conductor very well for these occasions because he wouldn't lose his temper and throw a fit. But before we'd get up the hill as far as Triple X, or maybe way back before that, a certain number of students would get up, and they would unscrew every light bulb in that streetcar. And by the time we'd get up the hill onto the campus, it was black, just black. And the conductor would just keep going and going and going, and we'd get down to where the turnaround was down at Cary Hall. And so we all hopped off, and it was dark as could be. Then you had to turn the streetcar around to head back. And some of these great big students, they actually could help turn this streetcar around to head it back. So it was not only the ball game, but there was a lot of excitement otherwise. So that's just one of the funny things that happened.
Do you have any special tradition, a campus tradition that kind of sticks in your mind that you sort of liked?
Well, one of the things that was done, I think it was a lot of fun. We had senior cords, and it started with the fellows having the yellow cords, and they would ride all over them and different things, and what school they were in, and sometimes they were really quite funny, or they'd have something from a comic strip or something of that nature. And then the girls started yellow corduroy skirts, and they would have ride all over that. Well, then one of the other things that went along with this was, they had the derbies at that time. And so the first football game, or you would wear these, and the first touchdown, the fellows with the derbies, all the hats would go in the air, and it was really, really, really a fun thing.
Yeah.
But the other sidelight on that was that the seniors had to be very careful in hiding these beforehand, because the freshmen and the underclassmen would steal them. And so a lot of them went under mattresses, and I don't know where all they went, but the places that they put them were really something to preserve them till the day of the game. And then the other thing I liked so much, and I know it was a lot of work, but it still was a fun thing. The fraternities and the sororities and co-ops and different organizations would make these beautiful decorations for football occasions. And usually they'd have something to say, and sometimes not too good, about the other school and what Purdue was going to do to them. But they were very, very clever, very creative signs. And people came from miles around, drive around, all around, all over campus to see these unusual, creative displays. And I don't know, I think they've tried a time or two to get this going again, but I don't think with much success. You know, television and computers, all these things killed off a lot of the creative, the fun things like this, where and that it made good friends, bonded the students when they were having a big project like that going. And of course, I think that race that they have in the spring is a good thing.
The Grand Prix.
Grand Prix, right. Yes. And I saw some of that. One sidelight I would have to tell you, this is one of our students was working on a car for the Grand Prix. And I had a manager that time. The hall manager was Bob Cadwell. And he was a good one. And he knew what was going on all the time, it seemed like. And so this student came up on the dock, and he was working on this car, and he'd worked all night on it, getting ready. And so my window of my office was, I could look out right on the dock. And so Bob Cadwell came along to this fellow, and he said, engaged him in conversation about his car and what he was doing with it and all of that. Bob kept looking it all over and everything. It turned out it was a Purdue lawnmower, a golf course lawnmower. He was modifying it with the motor for his car. And so Bob said, well, I think we better look into this and take it back where it belongs. Well, of course, the guy was, he's caught red-handed with the whole thing. So that ruined his car, did not participate. So that was one of the cute things, nice. Sidelight on that.
Do you have a favorite memory of Purdue that you'd like to share with us? Any favorite memory?
Well,
or just some general summary comments?
I think one, well, I have a couple of memories that I think are sharing. And you may remember in front of Fowler, the old hall, and I don't know what that tree was, but it was a huge spreading tree. And in it was very large, and I just about broke my heart when they cut it down. But under that tree, the students would gather with their books and they'd study, and there'd be in the lawn under that tree would be covered with students that would be studying. And that, I was thinking about that the other night. That's one thing about this interview that made me start thinking of all the good memories. That was one I think of. The other memory I think of course, one of the, as far as Purdue is concerned, and I was so sorry when they tore down Heveland Hall. That, another thing, it just about broke my heart. And R.B. Stewart, well, progress, supposedly.